Welcome along. It's the time of the week where we get a little bit bored with life down here on planet Earth and we set out for an incredible adventure. Strap in, explorers. It's a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Thank you for being there. Pleasure to have you along in our club of explorers as we try and search out some science secrets from across the solar system. This week, we will carry on our search for the best science around, and our competitor today is making the case for beetles.
They pollinate our plants. About half of our plants are pollinated that we eat, for example. They disperse seeds. They recycle waste. But they can also cause damage to us. They can eat our clothing, they can eat our houses, and they can compete with us for food.
Also, we've got another genius on answering a question that you have sent over to the free Fun Kids app. Today, looking at the sky, it's all about rainbows.
Every single rainbow is unique to your eyes because the way the light's bouncing around and the way it goes to you, you're seeing your own unique rainbow. So each person is seeing their own rainbow, just the way that the physics works. So it's absolutely unique and just for you.
And a deadly Asian insect makes it onto our dangerous Dan list. It's all on the way in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off with your science in the news. It's been a busy week. A genetic mutation makes some Labradors constantly hungry while burning fewer calories. That's a new discovery by scientists, which pretty much explains why some dogs can be a bit porky. They say it's a double whammy, which means if you own a Labrador, you need to pay special attention to keeping your dog slim. It's a gene mutation. It was found in a quarter of Labrador retrievers, and that means even though they're not losing weight, they're always hungry, and it does explain why some of our pets look the way they do, even though they're always on walks. So if you've got a Labrador, just keep your eye out for what you're feeding them. Also, scientists say they have discovered fossils belonging to a nightmarish sea lizard. It's a species that hunted the ocean 66 million years ago. It would have lived alongside dinosaurs like the Tyrannosaurus Rex, like Triceratops too. It's called the Kingaria acuta. It would have been about 8 meters long, which is the same size as an orca, a killer whale. They say it had dagger-like teeth. It would have scoured the ocean. How incredible is it? We heard about fossils last week on the podcast that 66 million years later, we can discover brand new animals, and it completely changes our view of what creatures lived back then. And our final story this week, a diverse wildlife habitat has been created in Hertfordshire in the UK. The nature reserve aims to provide hope for the future and support the ecosystem there. Josh Calms is from the Hertfordshire and Middlesex Wildlife Trust and joins us now. Josh, thank you for being there. Just tell us, what are the key stages for making a new wildlife habitat?
Firstly, it's very important to know what you've got already so you're not getting rid of anything important. Having a vision of what you want to create and why is an essential first step. And then getting the appropriate machinery and the right tools to do the job. And then certainly evaluating the project once it's been made.
So you said at the start there, finding out what you've got already. Why was this site chosen as a perfect place for a wildlife reserve?
Hillfield Reservoir is actually the oldest nature reserve in the county of Hertfordshire, and it has a lot of margin. So whether being a reservoir, it's got a lot of wetland. And we know that wetlands are so important for wildlife. They're supercharged ecosystems where so much wildlife lives. And the especially important bit is where the water meets the land. And we had a great opportunity here to change the way that edge of the reservoir is to really boost wildlife and biodiversity on this site.
You say to change where the water and the land meet, that edge. What do you mean? How do you create a wildlife reserve like this? What needs to happen?
So if you imagine you're, say, digging a pond in your garden, if you make the edges really steep, then there's not much area for wildlife to be in. And those edges are usually where the sun comes in and where it gets warm, and they're very productive. So it makes a lot of wildlife in those edges. but it has to be nice and shallow and sloping. So when you do your pond in the garden, you want to make it nice, gentle gradient, a gentle slope instead of a steep cliff. So here at Hilfer Reservoir, we've been changing the margins. So we've been creating more gentle gradient, a gentle edge, and making the edge wetter as well. So there's more space for wetland wildlife.
So this took a year to plan. Work started in November. It's opened recently. What have you immediately noticed? What big changes have happened almost straight away?
Well, the immediate change is there's a huge amount more light reaching the edge of the water body. And this has meant that there's a lot more exposed mud as well. And it's drawn in birds that don't normally come to this reserve. So there's a wading bird called a lapwing. And it's actually a bird that's in decline as a breeding species. So it's not doing very well. But here at Hillfield, this bird, which doesn't normally come here, has been landing on the area and feeding. So it's created an opportunity for these birds. Another thing is, as part of the work, we pushed out a lot of trees. Now, these trees were planted probably in the wrong place, quite close to the edge. They were shading out the edge. And as I've said already, we want the light to come in. We want that sunlit margin. So we took out those trees, some of which were what we call invasive species. They weren't supposed to really be there. And we've put them out in the water. Now, that has created a fantastic underwater submerged habitat for all sorts of fish. And also, we've noticed big numbers of ducks gathering around the edge of the new wetland areas. So that's another fantastic thing. So we've got wading birds and lots of ducks as well.
So that's happened very quickly in just the last few weeks. What are you expecting and hoping to happen in the next few years because of the changes you've made?
One of the areas we've created is going to become a large reed bed. And reed beds is a very rare habitat. It stands of a type of aquatic grass, essentially, called Phragmites. And we want these reed beds to spread because they're so rare and they're great for wildlife. So here, because of the work that's been done, the reed bed is going to spread into an area that was formerly not such a good habitat. And it's going to attract all sorts of fantastic wildlife. So we're hoping to get things like marshland type birds, like reed warblers and sedge warblers, reed buntings as well. And then we might attract breeding frogs and newts, toads perhaps. And the area should be fantastic in, imagine, 5 years' time, even sooner than that, hopefully, for dragonflies and damselflies. And this site is already pretty good for dragonflies and damselflies, but this work is really going to boost Hillfield, certainly to be one, if not the best site for dragonflies and damselflies in the county.
When you make changes like this, Josh, in the hope of attracting different creatures, how much do you need to think about the local ecosystem that is already there and maybe big effects it could have by introducing perhaps a predator to prey that hasn't known it before?
So we weren't directly introducing predators to the site in this case. I would say, though, that when we're creating a habitat like this, it's always important to look at what's there already. And the habitat that we were changing was mainly woodland along the edge. But we know that on the site, there's a huge amount of woodland anyway growing up. And these trees, you know, they grow themselves. We don't need to plant them, because the jays and the wood mice, they plant the acorns seeds blow in and they grow up. So we've got huge areas of grassland that's growing up with trees. So we want a good balance of habitats. And that is the best for biodiversity, having a load of varying habitat. So we knew that habitat was elsewhere on site. So we weren't too worried about getting rid of a bit of it to boost what is a rare habitat.
Well, the efforts that experts like you take is always amazing to hear. So thank you so much, Josh Carms from the Hertfordshire Middlesex Wildlife Trust. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Josh for coming on, for telling us all about this amazing habitat. And it's brilliant, isn't it, that we're so thoughtful today about other animals and we're constantly doing things to try and boost numbers of different species. I love that about science. Let's get to your questions then, and we'll chat to another genius I love this part. Every week you send over your science questions, queries, anything that you're wondering about the world when you've been exploring and you're thinking, is that right? Can that be? Well, ask me and we will discover it. The best way that you can do that is by leaving it as a voice note on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. Here's a brilliant, kind of gruesome one when you think about it, from Jacob.
How do our eyeballs move?
Thank you, Jacob. Is it gruesome? I don't know. Anything to do with the eye kind of creeps me out a bit. How do our eyeballs move? Well, the movement of our eyeballs is controlled by six muscles attached to each eye. And they work together. They come in pairs. So when one muscle stretches, the other one relaxes. When one pulls, the other one pushes, which allows really precise control over what your eyes are doing. The six muscles you've got the superior rectus, that moves the eye upwards. The other one, the inferior rectus, moves the eye downwards. You've got the medial rectus, which moves your eye towards your nose. You've got the lateral rectus, which moves the eye outwards. You've got something called the superior oblique, which can rotate the eye one way, and the inferior oblique rotates it the other way. So six muscles, and they're all working together. They're working in pairs to make sure when one pushes, the other pulls, one stretches, one relaxes. And that's why you've got really close control over your eyeballs. And it's all working with your brain. It's telling those muscles what to do based on impulses and nerves and senses and signals. So it's always working together. All of your senses, every part of your body is working with your brain so you instantly know what to do. And it is instant. It's really quickly instantaneous. Just think, I want to look right, bam. Your brain tells your muscles to move one way and that's what's happening with your eyeball. It's amazing, isn't it? How quickly, lightning speed, these things can happen. Jacob, thank you so much for the question. Let's get on another one. This is a voice note sent in from Matthew.
How does a rainbow form in the air?
Well, Matthew, thank you very much for that question. How are rainbows formed? And a brilliant way of putting it too, forming a rainbow. Let's find out with Kirsty McCabe, broadcast meteorologist and editor of the Royal Meteorological Society Matters blog. Kirsty, thank you for being there. I'm sorry I really struggled to say the word meteorological.
It's okay, I can barely spell it. Luckily, we shorten it to MET quite a lot. So yes, I write a lot of things for MET Matters, and one of those is explaining how things happen, why the sky's blue, how a rainbow's formed. And to form a rainbow, you just really need two things. You need to have the sun behind your head and you need to have an array of water droplets in the sky in front of you. And you don't just see rainbows when they form. You might have noticed sometimes a spray from a waterfall, a fountain, even a fog. You can see fog bows. And it occurs because of the way the sunlight's shining through the raindrops. So the light gets refracted as it goes into the raindrop and then reflected off the back of the droplet and then refracted again as it comes back out the drop towards our eye. So it's kind of going in, spreading out a little, bouncing off the back, coming back towards the spread out. And as each time it's refracted, it's split into its different colours because light's not just one colour, it's a whole spectrum of colours. And it splits it up into the rooibos, or however you like to remember it, the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. So you've got to have the sunlight though at just the right angle in order for it to refract and reflect off the water drop. So that happens mostly when the sun is low in the sky behind you. So in this country, rainbows usually seen in the western sky in the morning and in the east in the evenings.
So why does it always happen the same way with the colours being refracted? I would imagine if the light's going into the raindrop, then it's breaking apart, then it's bouncing off the other side, then it's breaking apart again. It's amazing to think that that wild process always leaves us with those colours in exactly the same order every single time.
Well, each colour has its own frequency or wavelength, and that determines how much it's bent when it enters the water droplet. So each bent by slightly different amounts, and that's why you end up with the red at the top and the purpley blues at the bottom. But what you might have seen is a double rainbow. The sunlight's not just reflected once off the water drop, it's bounced twice before it's come back out. And so this time it's flopped the rainbow the other way around. So you end up with blue in the top and red in the inside. So a normal traditional rainbow is red at the top. But if it's a double rainbow, then you've got it inverted. It's the other way around. And if you're really lucky, you might see a triple rainbow. And then that's the other way around. You're back to the red again at the top. So it's all to do with wavelength of light as well.
And we normally see a rainbow, a semicircle. It's half this arcing curve. But sometimes You can see full spheres, full circles, maybe if you're up on an aeroplane, or even sometimes if we've got water in our eyes, if we're in the swimming pool or something, and if you look at light, you can see those rings there. Why is that happening so uniformly?
Well, officially all rainbows would be a full circle, but you won't always see it if there's maybe not enough moisture in a particular part of the sky. So you're only going to see it where you've got the sun behind you and enough water droplets in the sky to bounce the light around. But yes, officially it would be a full circle. And I've heard it being described before as if you imagine picking up a traffic cone and holding it up to your eye so that you've got the smaller end near your eye, and the bottom of the traffic cone is like a circle. And that's kind of what you're seeing, is the bottom of that traffic cone is where the rainbow would be. And if you imagine then following back from the rainbow all the way back towards it, what's at the end of the rainbow? It's you. You are at the end of every rainbow that you see. And what's even better is that every single rainbow is unique to your eyes, because the way the light's bouncing around and the way it goes to you, you're seeing your own unique rainbow. So each person is seeing their own rainbow, just the way that the physics works. So it's absolutely unique and just for you.
Oh, that's amazing, because when everyone can see a rainbow in the sky, you're more or less pointing to the same
thing. All seeing slightly different things of the same one, depending where you're standing.
You know, obviously we're disappointed that the old tale of gold at the end of the rainbow is not true. But the fact that...
You're the gold.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, a really great way of thinking about it. Well, listen, we've done that, Matthew.
Well, do you want to know the best weather for finding rainbows?
Yeah, what's the best weather for finding rainbows, Kirsty?
Well, I mentioned earlier you need sun and water. So a traditional British weather type of sunshine and showers, you might have heard in the weather forecast. If you hear sunshine and showers, that's when you want to get out there and have a look and see if you can spot some rainbows. And if you get any pictures of rainbows, send them to me, because I love them. I think they're such a beautiful thing to see. I love seeing people's weather photos. Lots of my friends will send them to me. They don't even need to say why, they just send them. But we do have actually a weather photo competition at the Royal Meteorological Society, and you can send your weather photos there if you prefer. So that's where you could send in pictures of rainbows or nice clouds or anything. So there's a Young Weather Photographer of the Year competition kicking off next month, actually, 15th of April.
Wow. How do we find out more?
Details will be on the Royal Meteorological Society website, so rmets.org.
There you go. Rmets.
You'll be able to find out there. And you can find out more about how rainbows are formed as well, if you take a wee look.
Oh, there's so much going on, and I've loved chatting to you. Make sure, look, for me, for Kirsty, next time you see a rainbow, take a quick pic, send it to Kirsty. Find out more website. Listen, Kirsty McCabe from Rmets, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's get into this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we scour the universe to find some of the most weird, odd, strange, unique, and deadly things that lurk. This week, we are headed to China to search the ground and find the Chinese red-headed centipede. Its proper scientific name is Colopendra subspinipes mutilans. It's known as the Chinese red-headed centipede. It's a long, large species, can be about 20 centimetres long. Now, it's known for not just being venomous, but quite aggressive with its prey. They've got a jet-black body, yellowish legs, and guess what colour their head is? Bright blood red. 50 Science Weekly points, well done. Now, it grips its prey with its legs, piercing it with those pincers on the top. And it doesn't come into contact with humans often, but its bite is extremely painful, causing swelling, redness, itchiness, severe allergic reactions. Its venom can even be lethal. Now, here's something cool. The toxin, right, the venom that it pumps out, is called the spooky toxin, which perfectly describes what it does. And what's interesting is, even though this is a pretty deadly beast for a lot of animals, for years it has been used in medicine, traditional herbal medicines. In Korea and China, the centipedes are used whole to treat many illnesses, from strokes to mumps to joint problems and even snake bites. How amazing is that? Using one toxin, one animal, to try and counter the effects of another one. And it looks terrifying. Jet black, bright red head and pincers. And it can be fatal, which means the Chinese red-headed centipede goes straight onto our Dangerous Dan list. It's time to try and find the best type of science. Something we've done over the last few weeks. We've invited experts, geniuses on from all around the world to tell us and proved why their field should come first. This week, we're talking entomology insects, figuring them all out with Professor Chris Terrell-Neild from Nottingham Trent University. Chris, thank you for being there. We start it off as always. You have 1 minute to prove why entomology is the best in 3, 2, 1, go.
My expertise is the best because insects are so important. They're the largest group of animals on the planet. Have over 1 million species discovered and recorded. We think there could be 5.5 million species in total, so we've only just got about 20% of them. Now, I'm a coleopterist, which means I study beetles, and that's the largest group of insects. There are about 400,000 species of them. So, why are insects important? Well, they are at the base of the food web, just about everything eats them. They control pests. They can themselves be pests and transmit diseases. They pollinate our plants. About half of our plants are pollinated that we eat, for example. They disperse seeds. They recycle waste, for example, dead animals and dung. But they can also cause damage to us. They can eat our clothing, they can eat our houses, and they can compete with us for food.
There you go. And 1 minute, 1 minute, Chris. You've had your minute. That was perfect. And it's given me so many questions. So, you mention a huge amount of insect species that we know about, yet we predict that there are many, many more, that we only know about 20%. So why do we think that? Why do we think there are so many more creatures out there that we know of?
Partly because looking at the rate of discovery of new species, we find hundreds of new species each year, and it's a continuing process. But the main thing is we know that some areas which are very rich in insects are actually quite difficult to get to. So, for example, the tropical rainforest canopy is absolutely packed with insects, but is really relatively poorly studied. So are some areas of sort of high mountain habitats and other areas which are relatively inaccessible. So we think that there are many more species than we've actually recorded because we keep finding more and more and more of them.
Wow. So knowing that they were there, almost seeing their tiny footprints in your years of studying beetles and insects generally, what's the most jaw-dropping thing that you've learned? What's the most like amazing mind-bending fact that you've discovered about creatures?
One of the main beetles I studied originally was actually a thing called the devil's coach horse beetle. This is Britain's largest road beetle. It got to about 3 centimeters long. And I did a lot of research on that species. I bred them actually in the cellar of my parents' house. And I found out that they had certain behaviours. They were interested. They were like little pets, really. But then I started to look at them in more detail and find out that there was whole sorts of sort of mythological beliefs and things associated with them, which is why they're called devil's coach horses. So that got me really interested, for example, in the way in which beetles feature in mythology and ancient religion. For example, scarab beetles in ancient Egypt. You know, all sorts of things emerge because of that sort of interest. By looking at these creatures in the dark in the cellar and saying, yeah, come on, eat your chicken.
And just looking ahead, last question, say 50 years, for instance, 100 years, what would you really hope to have discovered? What are the big questions about the insect world, perhaps, or even specifically beetles that you really want to answer?
It's all about the future. Obviously, we're undergoing climate change. Things are happening. We're finding species in places that they didn't actually used to live in. Literally, just a few minutes ago, I've been looking at some spider species which actually occur in the Bristol area, which are almost certain appeared because of effectively escaping from ships that have been docking there. And I can see how they're travelling around. So one of my interests is to try to find out what is going to happen and try to predict where species may end up and perhaps what new species we may get here as it gets warmer and probably wetter. So I would like to say I've discovered that the conditions in an environment do indeed affect the species which are present now, and also species that you wouldn't expect to find in places which have appeared and how they change with time.
Professor Chris Terrell-Neild from Nottingham Trent University putting together a brilliant case for entomology. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Really great to chat with Chris. I love this part of the show because it's amazing to hear from people who have real passions. And that's what science is. You're interested in something, you learn more about it, and then you can do that as a proper job to discover stuff to help the world when you get older. And I'm really enjoying that. And we can find out more about biology, actually, and kind of the insects around the world with Marina Ventura. She is our trusty explorer. This is from her Inside Biology series. And this time it's about another insect. She's checking out ants.
Marina Ventura, Inside Biology, with the Society of Biology. Hold on tight.
Hiya. Today I'm checking out some of the cool ways insects work together. Let's have a closer look at this ant's nest. There are hundreds of ants swarming around their nest. They're not interested in us, though. They just want those tasty-looking leaves. The amazing thing is they're following exactly the same path to the leaves and back. But they haven't got a map, and ants can't talk to each other. So how are they doing it? If we get closer, we'll be able to see. Something smells pretty strong. Poo! Oh, that's very whiffy. That smell is ant pheromone, a chemical the ants leave, and it acts as a marker to lead others to the right place. You'd need to be another ant to smell it, normally. I think I'll leave them to it. Let's check out the nest. Here, under the ground, we can see chambers and tunnels branching off in all sorts of directions. Here come some worker ants, back with their leaves. And over there, some workers are tending to their eggs, whilst others are looking after the queen, the biggest ant of them all. A weird fact is that all the workers are female. There aren't many boy ants in a colony. Let's get back out into the open air. Ant colonies work together so brilliantly and efficiently that sometimes they're called superorganisms. That means they're almost like one living thing. Or like a machine. Maybe we could learn something from the ants and work together instead of sometimes being selfish. What do you think, Map App?
Well, possibly. You don't get selfish ants. Or if you do, they won't last in the colony very long.
The electronic essential for every explorer.
Human beings have learned that it makes sense to cooperate instead of fighting with each other all the time. It's unlikely we'll ever work quite as closely as the ants for a couple of good reasons. First of all, it's thought that the ants' behaviour is instinctive. They don't decide to work together. It's something that's as much a part of them as having six legs. Secondly, human beings are thought to be naturally selfish. Not like grabbing the biggest piece of cake. It's more about making sure that we eat when we're hungry and look for shelter if we're cold. We're pretty good at looking after ourselves, whereas ants and other social insects are hardwired to look after the whole colony.
But remember, it still makes good sense to share. That's all for now. In the meantime, find out more at funkidslive.com/biology.
Marina Ventura, Inside Biology, with the Society of Biology. Hold on tight.
You can hear more from Marina wherever you've got this podcast. It's on Google, Apple, Spotify, all of those places, and the free Fun Kids app. Thank you so much for listening to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We will be back next week with more journeys, more adventures, more exploring the universe. You can hear loads of the brilliant series you've heard today on Google, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids are our children's radio station from the UK. Listen all around the country on our website, on the app, or if you've got a smart speaker, wake it up and ask it to play Fun Kids.